It's The Takeaway for August 29th. I'm Arun Vanigopal, in for Tanzina Vega. A media blackout in Kashmir is masking a government crackdown on protesters.
Some of the people that I spoke with, they said, if you make us feel like prisoners, we have no choice but to come out on the streets and protest and demand our rights.
Also on the show, Major League Soccer wants to keep political statements out of its stadiums. Now some fans are pushing back.
The absurdity of the rule has just led to more and more people learning what the Iron Front symbol is, and more people taking the opportunity to stand up against incipient fascism.
Plus, this week marks 2 years since the start of the Rohingya crisis, and we talk about the babies being born in Bangladesh's refugee camps. And finally, this summer, a number of major movies have been headlined by South Asian leads.
You know, that's how he's looking. I wouldn't change what he's cooking.
You're the first people on Earth to hear this song.
Is a dream a lie if it don't come true? Or is it something worse?
All that coming up. Let's get to it. No internet. No cell phones. No landlines. For over 3 weeks, India has imposed a media and communication blackout in Kashmir. In early August, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose party embraces Hindu nationalism, revoked the autonomy of the Muslim-majority state, arrested local leaders, and imposed political rule from New Delhi. The blackout has meant that millions of people in the state have not been able to communicate with the outside world, so reports on conditions in Kashmir have been scarce.
What we saw was anger building up in people, and there's only so much that people are able to hold back.
Karan Singh is a freelance journalist who's been working with the New York Times to report on Kashmir. He went to Srinagar, the largest city in Kashmir and at the heart of one of the world's most militarized conflict zones. Karan spoke with us about this blackout and how India's deployment of tens of thousands of troops to Kashmir is making a volatile political situation even worse.
They've basically been asked to stay inside their houses. These are young people who've been running businesses. These are people who've been going to shops. They have work to do, and they're being asked to sit at home. They're being asked to stay inside. It's almost like a prison. Some of the people that I spoke with, they said, if you make us feel like prisoners, we have no choice but to come out on the streets and protest and demand our rights.
People have taken to the streets and protested, and they've been met by heavily armed police who've often used force against protesters.
The security forces in Kashmir have license to shoot with near impunity, and we saw security forces reacting to protests with pellet guns and also tear gas. And if you're shot from close range, people who we spoke with, they said they even had the entire cartridge lodged in their flesh. It penetrates the skin. These are lead pellets. When fired, they're literally sprayed across, and anyone can get hit, like children, women. People lose their eyesight when they're shot with pellets.
These injuries have put a strain on the hospital system in Kashmir, where the blackout has severely hampered medical services.
In one hospital alone, we heard about 60 cases of pellet injuries. And I think the communications blackout also has an effect on the medical emergencies in Kashmir. Doctors are not able to source medicines because they're not able to communicate with their suppliers. Hospitals are not able to source prescription drugs. These are life-saving drugs, and they're running out.
India's crackdown on communication in Kashmir is an especially harsh example of something we've been seeing more of around the world, digital authoritarianism. Alina Polyakova is the director of the Brookings Institution Project on Global Democracy and Emerging Technology. Alina, thank you for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
You've been studying the rise of digital authoritarianism. So what did you think when we first learned about the communication blackout in Kashmir?
When this happened in India, it was quite shocking to see a democracy move so aggressively to basically limit, censor, and block those residents residing in Kashmir's ability to communicate, to talk about what's happening. It's a real infringement and violation of free speech and the ability for free assembly as well.
So yes, India, widely considered the world's largest democracy, is this not common amongst so-called democracies?
Over the last few years, we've seen China experiment with some bans like this. We've seen Russia move to try to experiment with these kinds of internet social media blogs. There are some reports that the Chinese government is actually considering either a partial or complete ban on Hong Kong, given the protests that are going there. This is a tool that we're seeing authoritarian regimes deploy, but in some cases, we've also seen countries like Sri Lanka over this past spring, following some quite shocking terrorist attacks. Sri Lanka also put a temporary internet ban on parts of the territory to prevent what they said was extremist content, conspiracy theories from spreading on social media sites that would have amplified or misled people about the nature of the attacks. So we're seeing these kinds of bans being experimented with primarily by authoritarian regimes. But I think what's becoming troubling with India is that we're now seeing some democracies doing this as well.
And to what extent do you think that there is a backlash to these models? Does it actually create more problems than it tries to solve?
Well, I think, we have to distinguish between, democratic societies, free and fair elections, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, et cetera. And again, I think what's troubling about what's happening in India is that we're seeing this within the context of a democracy, which raises serious questions. What is the role of the digital space in democratic societies during, perhaps, emergency situations? And some would say that, what's happening in Kashmir was a problem of the Indian government's own making, of course. And this is not a state of emergency that doesn't justify what the government is doing in terms of banning any access to the internet. When it comes to authoritarian regimes, this is where we're seeing the really shocking use of digital technologies, things like artificial intelligence algorithms, to surveil in a really profound way the entire population, to try to censor people, repress their ability to speak out, and track people's movements throughout the country. In China, the surveillance state has really grown at a rapid rate, and we don't really even understand the implications of it quite yet. And of course, in countries like Russia, they're trying to replicate this Chinese model with some limited success. And other countries are looking on in Africa, in South America, and they want these kinds of capabilities and technologies as well to be able to control their own domestic populations.
You write about two models of digital authoritarianism, the Chinese model and the Russian model. Can you briefly describe these two models?
Sure. What we've seen emerge in China really since the initial days of internet penetration in that country in the mid-90s, we saw the Chinese government very, very quickly from the very beginning to limit and censor what kind of information was getting into China. We now colloquially call this the Great Firewall of China. But what that really refers to is the Chinese government's strategic intent from 20 years ago to filter the information that is getting in front of Chinese citizens. And since then, the Chinese government has only developed new forms of surveillance technologies like video cameras that are now coupled with facial recognition software. The use of Chinese-made social media platforms versus Western platforms, which are banned in China, of course. Now there's a social score system that the Chinese government is moving to implement that will fully allow the Chinese government at a very micro, deep, personal level to surveil every single citizen. What we see in Russia is a little different. So in the 1990s, Russia had an opening, and the internet developed in a relatively free way. And so once, social media apps are out there, other Western platforms and technologies are already out there being used by the population, like YouTube, it's really difficult to roll that back. And so now we see also a series of protests that have been happening in the last few weeks in Moscow. And many of those protesters are using YouTube to stream instances of police abuse, to broadcast their message. YouTube and other Western outlets have become the key way in which democratic activists and protesters have been able to get the truth across to a broader swath of the population. The Russian government, because of that, actually sent a very threatening letter to YouTube, to Google, threatening them with interference in Russian domestic politics because they were allowing protests to stream examples and video from the protests. They're not succeeding in the same way that the Chinese are, but certainly they are moving quickly to try to replicate that model.
When we talk about how Russia and China have been exporting their own forms of digital authoritarianism, which countries are actually importing them?
So, unfortunately, there's a lot of interest across the world in having access to these surveillance technologies. We know that at least 18 countries currently use Chinese surveillance and monitoring system, everything from video cameras to other forms of facial recognition technology, etc. And the Russians are also part of this game. They have been exporting their surveillance technologies to places like Venezuela, to places like Belarus, Central Asia. And I think this is something we need to be paying a lot of close attention to because it is a profound challenge to what we think of as democratic governance values and principles.
Going back to the situation in Kashmir, the communications blackout there has been especially severe, but it also seems to have been working from the point of view of the Indian government. Do you think that we'll see this move imitated in other places, including in other democracies?
I think, again, the damage, that's the reputational damage, the damage to democratic principles, values, ideals, is really profound. People on the ground can find ways to get around some of these bans. I think in Kashmir, it is this full blackout ban. It's not a partial ban that we've seen in some other places before. I think democracies on the hand should be paying very close attention to the fact that this kind of ban that the Indian government is carrying out today in Kashmir only breeds resentment and anger among the residents of that region. It's in the long run, it's not going to serve democratic principles to impose these kinds of ban, and certainly goes against free speech and free amendment rights that we have in the United States, free speech rights that you have in all European countries. So I would be really shocked to see another democracy implement these kinds of measures. And I would certainly hope it doesn't become a pattern.
Alina Polyakova is the director of the Brookings Institution's Project on Global Democracy and Emerging Technology. Alina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Arun.
This week marks 2 years since the start of the mass exodus of more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar to Bangladesh. The ethnic minority began fleeing after a brutal crackdown by armed forces began in 2017. And as Buddhist-majority Myanmar continues to deny Rohingya people citizenship and leave them stateless, roughly 60 Rohingya babies are being born every day in Bangladesh's refugee camps. That's according to a UNICEF report from last year. Thurjoy Chowdhury is an independent photographer in Bangladesh who published a photo series on these stateless babies in National Geographic's August 2019 issue. Thurjoy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
So you've been covering the Rohingya crisis since it started in 2017. Tell me, how has the situation evolved over the last 2 years?
It's not a new issue, actually. The history and the background of Rohingya refugee crisis is very complicated. And in different time periods, we have seen different kind of influx. So I basically started this project named Border Refugee. Initially, the situation was really horrible. There were no facilities of drinking water and no sanitation facilities. But gradually, different organizations, they started working. And right now, the situation little stable. But at the same time, we cannot say that we have any perfect solution for this issue because it's about the citizenship. And we have to resettle these people.
So this series of yours, Born Refugee, it's focused on babies who are born inside the camps. Can you describe what you've been seeing inside the camps?
So when the influx started, I observed that all the medias, all of the world, they were just focusing on the incident, which is definitely important. But at the same time, probably nobody was thinking about the future. And I was roaming around in the refugee camp, and suddenly I heard baby crying. So the refugees were leaving kind of a temporary shelter, like shanties or shacks. So I entered into that shelter and I came to know that that's just a one-day-old baby girl. And she was wrapped with a red blanket. And when I asked the permission to take a picture of the baby, the mother unwrapped her and approached to me and asked me to have a better look. So while taking that picture, the visuals was something very simple. It's kind of a top shot. The baby was lying down on a red blanket. The background was completely red. And it was a very simple visual. But I started thinking about all the complexities of the geopolitics and all the horrible things that happened back there in Myanmar. And this baby was completely innocent. And from that very moment, I started working on the series that I'm gonna portray these babies as just innocent babies. I'm not showing them as refugee. The visuals are pretty simple. There are different colorful backgrounds like red, blue, green. Those are basically the blankets given to them as relief aid. And in the pictures, babies are crying, laughing, playing, sometimes sleeping. Kind of a juxtaposition that I wanted to make, because the context, the story is horrible, but at the same time, these are just innocent babies who have actually nothing to do with this politics.
I was struck by the fact that some of the babies you photographed are as young as a day old. One of them, at least the one online at the National Geographic website, still has its umbilical cord attached. It's quite unsettling, but at the same time, I was struck by the fact that these mothers, these families, allowed you access and allowed you to photograph their children. Did you get a sense of why, in this vulnerable state, they were willing to have you photograph their children?
Well, honestly speaking, what I have realized that moment, they were completely blank. They literally had no idea what to do and where to go. Most of them were traumatized because of witnessing whatever happened back there in Myanmar. So I guess they wanted to tell the world what's happening. Before taking these pictures, I had long conversations with the mothers and the fathers, and I was trying to know and understand their struggle, their lifestyle over there, and what kind of challenges they're facing. At a point, when I asked about the babies, it was more like a trust building. And in a way, I would say that they understood that probably this is going to help them in a way.
So you say that for the many of the parents, they just have sort of a blank expression. Did they talk about issues of identity, statelessness, citizenship, this sort of limbo state that they're living in?
Absolutely. It happened several times. I asked them that, what do you want to do now? Do you want to go back or do you want to stay here? So it was kind of a mixed feeling. They were completely insecure, I would say. They were so scared to go back. But at the same time, they were telling me that that's our land, so we need to go back. But we cannot be back right at this moment because they are literally killing us. At the same time, some of them were not even concerned about the future of these babies because it's more complicated.
I'm sure for many of them, there is a concern about the future education of their children. Do any of these children receive education in these camps?
Well, honestly speaking, first of all, the majority of the crowd, the Rohingya refugee crowd, they are not that much educated. So I have seen many other organizations and NGOs. They were actually working on educational facilities, and they were trying to bring children in their unofficial school or educational center. But here, this issue is more critical because all these babies, in fact, in the pictures, all the babies were in the womb when they crossed the border and they were born in the refugee camp. So technically, the citizenship issues is really complicated because according to the Bangladesh Citizenship Act, if a child born in Bangladesh to alien parents cannot be citizen of Bangladesh by birth or by descent. That means like the children born to two Rohingya parents will never be considered citizens of Bangladesh. So on the other hand, according to the Myanmar citizenship law, they're not going to treat these newborns as Myanmar citizens, as they will be considered to have been migrated to Bangladesh. Moreover, according to the law, Rohingyas are not considered a national race of the country. It's really complicated for these particular babies, and without any identity, without any official documents, it's next to impossible to get enrolled into any official curriculum or educational system. So I would say the future of these babies are completely uncertain.
Thurjoy Chaudhary is an independent photographer based in Bangladesh. Thurjoy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last week, two of the biggest rivals in U.S. soccer, the Portland Timbers and the Seattle Sounders, met on the pitch. Saying their matches and their fans are rowdy is usually an understatement. There is cheering, screaming, chanting, drumming, but Friday's game was different. For the first 33 minutes of the game in Portland, many fans stayed silent. And then this happened. At that moment, fans raised banners and flags all at once, many of them bearing anti-fascist slogans, as well as the symbol of the Iron Front, a 1930s-era German paramilitary group formed in opposition to the rise of the Nazi regime. These were in blatant violation of a new rule issued by Major League Soccer, banning fans from bringing anything bearing political language or symbols to games. That touched a nerve in Portland, which has been the site of several high-profile incidents of white supremacist violence. Jules Boykoff was at the game. He's a professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon, and he's a former professional soccer player, and he joins us now. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Jules.
Thanks, Arun.
This was all about a rule change by Major League Soccer this year for how fans should conduct themselves during games. According to their website, fans are banned from bringing signs or anything with, quote, political, threatening, abusive, insulting, offensive language and or gestures, which includes racist, homophobic, xenophobic, sexist, or otherwise inappropriate language or behavior. Now, most of that sounds pretty reasonable, but it was the barring of political language that riled people up. Why?
That's exactly right. Most of that is pretty common in other football, soccer leagues around the world. But banning political speech on banners and signs inside of stadiums, that's really what was unique.
So give me a sense of, I guess, of what it felt like to be at the game. What was it like being in the stands?
I have never in all my days as a soccer fan experienced anything like this. The silence was eerie. It was freaky. And it was like this white noise murmur that was on the verge of bursting. And when it burst, it just this huge release of energy and like nothing I'd ever seen before. And to think what it was like to coordinate with the arch rival side, the much hated Seattle Sounders here in Portland, to coordinate with their fans to make this happen, because the Seattle fans on hand as well stayed silent for those first 33 minutes. It was an incredibly coordinated act, and it really had a powerful effect in the stadium.
A lot of the protest was centered on the symbol for the Iron Front, a symbol I'd never seen before this. What is this, and why is it important to soccer fans in Portland?
Well, the Iron Front symbol is basically three arrows pointed diagonally down. You'll often see it inside of a circle. And it was created by socialists as a rebuke to fascism that was emerging under Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. The Nazis banned the Iron Front symbol in 1933, which accounts for the decision to start the match with exactly 33 minutes of silence. And it's been part of soccer culture for a while, very political fan base here in Portland. And the other thing that they did, though, which was really striking for the soccer fans in Portland, was they refused to raise a TIFO. A TIFO is one of these large banners that is sort of hoisted up by rope and pulley, and they're often present at the big rivalry matches, in our case against Seattle and Vancouver. And there was no TIFO whatsoever. So this was another sort of silent protest that a lot of the people that are big soccer fans in Portland most assuredly noticed.
I'm here with Jules Boykoff, and we're talking about last weekend's protest of Major League Soccer's decision to ban political speech and symbols from the stands. The rule is new this season, but it's been in place since March. So why are fans protesting now?
Well, Major League Soccer doubled down recently. It should be pointed out that it's the only league in North America that has such a rule banning political speech on banners and signs. And, you know, I think it's the context of Portland where you have a very spirited fan base and you have all the sort of, I guess, what people have been calling really an invasion of white power folks coming mostly from Vancouver, Washington, down into Portland for these standoffs that have happened month after month. This means we have to mobilize the police, the mayor gets involved, And we've spent $50,000 just on barriers to separate the anti-fascist protesters from those who are visiting from elsewhere to spread their white power message. And so, you know, this all came to a head. And I think that's why you're really seeing a lot of these streams coming together in Portland and why you've seen such friction around this rule.
This wasn't the only soccer game in Portland last weekend. On Sunday, the city's women's team, the Thorns, played. What was the atmosphere like at that one?
It was similarly rambunctious. The Rose City Riveters hung numerous political signs. They also had these white roses that symbolized the White Rose Resistance Group that worked against the Nazis in the 1940s in Germany. And what's interesting is there is no rule in the Professional Women's League in the United States that bans political speech. But the Timbers ownership, the front office, decided to apply the Major League Soccer rule to the Thorns as well as to its second division club that it also owns, known as Timbers 2 here. And they published an open letter saying that it would be easier for the staff that works those games to have the same rule across the board, which a lot of fans that I spoke with and interviewed here in Portland found to be pretty hollow.
This, at the same time, it strikes me as something that is impossible to police. I mean, a symbol can be tweaked, adapted in certain ways to kind of evade very harsh and strict sort of monitoring. Does the absurdity of this, I guess, cross the minds of the people who are trying to enforce this?
I would say the absurdity of the rule has just led to more and more people learning what the Iron Front symbol is and more people taking the opportunity to stand up against incipient fascism and burgeoning racism in the United States. And I think for that reason, it's really important what happened in Portland. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens this weekend when Timbers Army's back in full force for a match against another rival, Salt Lake City.
Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player and is currently a professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you, Arun.
Back with you now on The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and today for Tanzina Vega. Until relatively recently, when Hollywood included South Asian characters on screen, more often than not, it meant exaggerated foreign accents and comedic relief. In movies like Short Circuit from 1986, white actors wore brown face to play ridiculous Indian characters. But this summer marks what feels like a new chapter when it comes to South Asian actors getting cast in a range of lead roles. From Yesterday, starring Himesh Patel.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me.
To Late Night, a movie written by and starring Mindy Kaling.
If you have a problem, ask a chemist. She'll always have the solution.
To this month's Blinded by the Light, headlined by Vivek Kalra.
Is a dream a lie if it don't come true? Or is it something worse?
So while Hollywood still has a ways to go when it comes to increasing the number of South Asian people working in front of and behind the camera, it seems like, at least on some level, things are starting to change. I have two people with me now to discuss this recent spate of movies. Shilpa Dave is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and the author of Indian Accents, Brown Voice and Racial Performance in American Television and Film. Thanks for being here, Shilpa.
Thanks, Arun, for inviting me.
Also with us is Aseem Chhabra, an entertainment writer and the festival director for the New York Indian Film Festival. Hey, Aseem.
Hi, Arun.
All right, Aseem, when we look at this recent spate of movies, including Stuber, starring Kumail Nanjiani, to what extent is this a new trend?
Well, so it's hard to say if it's really a trend, because two of the films that played this summer actually are British films. Yesterday was a British film, Danny Boyle's, as well as Blinded by Light, made by a British Indian filmmaker, Gurinder Chadha. And the Brits have usually been more in the forefront of kind of, you know, giving more of a chance and opportunity to brown Asian actors, characters. Hollywood has been a lot slower in that regard, but there are people, obviously, they're breaking the glass ceiling. Mindy Kaling, as you mentioned, besides having her own show, she started off as a writer on Office and, you know, then acted in it, and then she had her own show. And this summer, she wrote and acted, played the lead role in the film Late Night with Emma Thompson. And also, Mindy hired an Indian-American filmmaker, director, Nisha Ganatra. She could have easily hired a white Caucasian director for the film, but she wanted sort of a South Asian Indian perspective to the character.
Shilpa, what about you? Does this feel momentous in any sense to you?
Well, I think I agree with Asimans that we're seeing, you know, British films really doing something interesting. And I wonder if that's a reaction to Brexit, too, as well. And the idea that you're having Britain seen as the cosmopolitan place where you can talk about sort of racial difference and depict racial difference, but also have it in relationship to music, too. So the groups, especially in Blinded by the Light and in Yesterday, that they were singing were, it was the Beatles, which was, you know, going back to the 60s. And then you had Bruce Springsteen, which was the 80s. And that was set in Thatcher 80s, which was, you know, a much more conservative period. I found it interesting that in Blinded by the Light, the main character goes to New Jersey, to Bruce Springsteen's hometown, but at New Jersey at that same time where in Edison you were getting the Dotbusters. So I find that the sort of sense of nostalgia with these films is a little bit interesting in this moment, because it's like, how do we see South Asians in a racial and class context? And yes, I like the fact that, you know, with both of these films, they were doing that. Late Night is a little bit different, because I think what Mindy Kaling is doing, and with Nisha Ganatra, who, you know, has directed independent films going back into the 90s.
Chutney Popcorn. She's really, yeah.
Yeah, Chutney Popcorn was a great film, actually. And I think that what we want to see is, what is the American experience? And it's counter to the way that we think about, you know, Hollywood and even the American experience of South Asians in the U.S. as different from British. So she's trying to do something different. And she also is now the executive producer of Four Weddings and a Funeral,
Mindy
set
is.
In London.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which she has one of the main characters of that ensemble piece also being an Indian, British Pakistani character.
You know, there's a part of me that feels like, even with all these Desi films coming out, and of course all the TV stars that have kind of blossomed in the last few years, you'll never see the sort of hype and even like euphoria that we associate with the release of, say, Crazy Rich Asians last year. Is it just a matter of time, Shilpa, or do you think the issue of representation for East Asians is fundamentally different than it is for South Asians?
I think in South Asians, and I go back to my own experience, is that I always had Bollywood. And so to me, Crazy Rich Asians was actually reference to Bollywood, especially in some of those elaborate sequences that they did. I feel like it was really drawing from that particular moment. So we already sort of have that, mm-hmm, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, when Pride and Prejudice came out, that was a big moment. But I think in terms of the worldwide phenomenon, what is it about that film? It was beautiful, and it also showed something different, which was an Asian American woman being our point of reference and taking us into an Asian cultures. And that was the real interesting point. If we had something like when Cal Penn was going into The Namesake, you know, that was another way in which Meera Nair took an Indian American character and took that character into India. And that was a pretty big hit, too, as well. So I think you want to think about perspective and also how we look at what is American as opposed to just an NRI non-resident Indian.
Asim, you split your time between New Delhi and New York. To what extent do you think Hollywood and Western films in general are catering not just to the diasporic audience, Indians or South Asians in America, but to the global Indian audience, including, of course, all the people in India?
So there are a couple of cases of, in recent times when they rebooted Baywatch from the television show to the film. They cast Priyanka Chopra as the villain. You know, that show was very, very popular in India. Baywatch, when it was, you know, cable television just starting in India at that point, and everyone was watching the show. The film didn't do well. It didn't do well here. It didn't do well in India also. Also, one of the last XXXs, the Bollywood actress Deepika Padukone was cast in it. Many of these franchises, as we know, don't do that well in the US, but the studios are still pushing them because China is a very, very big market. India can be a very big market. Unfortunately, it did not work very well. But next year, Kumail Nanjiani is coming as one of the superheroes in The Eternals, which is a Marvel.
That's huge.
Is huge. The only other similar story is of another Pakistani British actor, Riz Ahmed, who was in one of the last Star Wars, really.
That's right.
So that is huge. When you start to act in a film, you know, and you cast a brown South South Asian actor in a Star Wars kind of a Marvel Comics film. We're talking about times are changing, definitely.
Shilpa, I'm curious. I mean, you've been studying representation of brown people on screen for a while now. When we talk about, say, East Asian films, there are long-running concerns and frustrations with how, say, Asian American men have been portrayed, a certain emasculation that they're still in some ways trying to overcome. What do you think South Asian actors and actresses are trying to overcome in terms of representation?
Well, it's about, and especially in an American context, it's about giving an alternative to a black-white racial binary. And so how does the idea of brown fit in to this racial landscape? And I think in the, sort of 21st century, we can see how there is still this immigration story. But, you know, Indians have been here for over 100 years. I mean, the Punjabi Sikhs came in the 19-teens. And so there is a long history. But with the different kinds of laws that were preventing people from Asia coming to the United States, it's this post-1965 that you start to see larger and larger populations. And we see it in the political sphere. So we have, you know, people like Kamala Harris and Nikki Haley, who are, you know, strong women. But yet we don't see that necessarily reflected in film. So a lot of the films that we see really feature Asian men. But where are the women? So when we talk about masculinity, I think with South Asian men, it's still this pursuit of an interracial relationship, and it's usually heteronormative. With South Asian women, you're starting to see something that's a little bit different, but that's what people talk about is how does, in our everyday life, how do we depict what our cultural background is, but also show that our cultural context is American? What does someone who is South Asian and American look like? And we keep on seeing the child of immigrant story, which I think is really important. But what other kinds of stories can we tell?
Real quick, Asim, any films that you're excited about coming up or even TV shows?
Well, I mentioned I'm going to Toronto next week, and I'm really very, very keen to see how Dev Patel plays David Copperfield. Mm-hmm. You have a brown Gujarati British actor who's going to play the ultimate classic white character.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Dickens. Shilpa Dave is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. And Asim Chhabra is an entertainment writer and the festival director for the New York Indian Film Festival. Thank you both for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Arun.
All right, people, that's it for me this week. It's been great filling in for Tanzina. She's back next week. And Amy Walters in tomorrow. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Danny Lewis, Andre Zohara, Jason Tureski, Jivika Verma, Josh Christensen, and the amazing Isabel Angel, who we are bittersweetly saying goodbye to this week. David Gable is our administrative assistant. Pauli Arungu is our digital editor. Claire McKean is our board operator and engineer. Jay Cowett directs the show and manages the tchotchkes, and Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks to all of them, and thanks to you for hanging out with us. Hit us up on Twitter at The Takeaway or me at ArunNYC. We'll see you soon. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.